This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support this free service by September 5th and you could win a Mini Cooper S convertible. Go to KCRW.com for details.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Climate change in Alaska and political reality. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. John McCain and Hillary Clinton are touring Alaska this week, getting a chilly welcome on the front lines of global warming. As winters get warmer and shorter, glaciers are shrinking and villages are undermined by melting permafrost. The visiting senators are calling for action before it's too late, but Alaska's own politicians are saying, wait and see. On To the Point, we'll hear what rising temperatures are doing to Alaska's ecology and to civilization, both ancient and modern. What does it mean for the rest of the 49 states? On Reporter's Notebook later on, race and gender in American medicine. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To the Point. John McCain and Hillary Clinton are studying climate change in Alaska, calling for action before it's too late. On To the Point, what's the impact in the region where temperatures are rising faster than any place else in the world? What does it mean for the rest of America? On Reporter's Notebook, the race and gender divide in American health care. First, this news update. Two Democratic governors, Bill Richardson of New Mexico and Janet Napolitano of Arizona, have declared states of emergency along their borders with Mexico. That has embarrassed the Bush Department of Homeland Security, but California's Republican Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger says he might do the same thing. Claudine LaMonaco reports for the Tucson Citizen. Claudine, what is the reason given by these governors for the states of emergency?
The reason are the really large numbers of people that are crossing through the Arizona desert in terms of illegal immigrants and also in terms of drugs that are just pouring across the border. And it's had a big impact. It's put a big strain on the border counties and towns, and that these are, you know, some of them pretty small entities, and yet they pick up the bill. And in terms of law enforcement, in terms of emergency medical care and search and rescue, unfortunately involved with the high number of people in trouble out there and dying. So, and at a state level, Napolitano really feels that, you know, this is a federal issue and the federal government hasn't been dealing with it. And so this is a way to direct at least, you know, a pretty small amount of money towards these border counties, but also bring attention to the issue.
What amount of money are we talking about and what would it be used for?
She has allotted $1.5 million for four border counties, and that comes from an emergency fund, a $4 million emergency fund that's usually used to fund, you know, if there's fires or floods, that sort of thing. The money is directed towards trying to help law enforcement on the ground, so it is pretty specific. And the idea being, you know, even if it's a small sum, to be able to help these counties and cities offset the cost of illegal immigration somehow so they can get more officers on the street.
You, of course, are in Arizona. Is Governor Richardson doing roughly the same thing for the same reasons in New Mexico?
Yeah, although it's interesting. I mean, his problem, our problem way out, you know, overshadows his problem. I mean, we have, you know, more than 500,000 people a year being caught here in Arizona, and I think he has about 30,000 so far. But yes, he's doing it for similar reasons.
Now, would those reasons include, for either of these Democratic governors, politics?
Well, I mean, yes, you have to say that, but because, I mean, there is an election coming up, and especially in Arizona, the Republicans here with Proposition 200, and also then in the spring, Proposition 200, which was the, you know, trying to crack down on services administered to illegal immigrants, and then after that in the spring, the Republicans made a lot of noise and passed a lot of bills that just tried to strengthen that and make it more difficult. Most of those bills were actually quite symbolic in that the state really doesn't have the power to to deal with that. So I think they'd like to name this issue as theirs, but they can't. I mean, the reality is it's a huge issue for everybody in Arizona, and this is actually a concrete step in terms of money being sent. And the governor also, I think in the spring as well, sent a bill to the federal government for several millions of dollars to also try to address. It was, you know, largely symbolic. Of course, I don't think the federal government responded in one way or another, but to try to help, again, cover these costs.
We're talking with Claudine LaMonica, who's a border and immigration reporter for the Tucson, Arizona Citizen. Well, how has the Department of Homeland Security responded to all of this?
Well, they have you know, defended their the work that they're doing along the border. Although clearly, I mean, it's just not enough. You talk to anybody here. And, you know, you talk to any rancher who lives down on the border, and they're constantly dealing with, you know, broken fences, broken water pipes, this sort of stuff. So the Department of Homeland Security can say they're doing everything, and Border Patrol can say they're doing everything, but the reality here is clear to everybody.
The congressmen and senators are home this week. There's a recess. What are they hearing from their constituents, do you think?
Oh, I think it's been, you know, it's just building. I mean, the people in Arizona want the federal government to deal with this because they feel like the federal government has shirked this responsibility. And especially the people on the border are picking up the bill because it's federal policy that's, you know, basically bringing these people through the Arizona desert. And they feel like it's a federal responsibility to control the border.
Okay. We've heard about the Minutemen, of course, earlier. Now the politicians are getting into the act, electoral politics, part of the reason. We'll see if it has any impact in Washington when Congress comes back. Meantime, thanks a lot for being with us.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Claudine LaMonica, border and immigration reporter for the Tucson Citizen. In a moment, climate change in Alaska and political reality on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman Elney back with To the Point. Alaska's melting permafrost and shrinking glaciers are concrete evidence that global warming is real. That's the consensus of most scientists, and it's the conclusion of Hillary Clinton and John McCain, who are visiting Alaska this week with fellow senators. But Alaska's own senators and its lone congressmen are not accompanying the delegation. All of them say the human cause of global warming is still in doubt, and they're opposed to new regulations being proposed by their colleagues. We'll begin our program with a look at the impact of climate change in Alaska. Matthew Sturm is a geophysicist with the Cold Regions Research and Engineering Lab in Fairbanks, run by the Army Corps of Engineers. Matthew Sturm, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What would you say are the biggest and most obvious signs of global warming in Alaska, and what are the impacts?
Well, the biggest signs so far, if we start out on the ocean, there's an ocean north of Alaska called the Arctic Ocean, and the sea ice there has been declining. It's changing in three ways. First, there's less of it. So late in the summer, about now, there's less white ice floating around in that ocean than there used to be. It's thinner, and the timing of when the ice actually shows up along our northern coast, it seems to be getting later. And so that's one of the biggest impacts, that change in the sea ice. It's an important change because the ice is white and it reflects sunlight and therefore helps keep a place like Alaska and the globe a little bit colder. And as we replace it with water, that's a much better absorber. That's one really big change. If we move on to land, a very visible change, one that's pretty easy for tourists to see, they see it all the time, is they look at our beautiful glaciers here in Alaska. And most of them, you can see a zone in front of them where they used to be. They're shrinking. Now, glaciers can shrink for other reasons, but when you see most of them doing the same thing, that's a good indication that the climate must be drier and warmer, because those are the two things that are going to make glaciers shrink. So that's the second. The third, in the area I tend to work in, is the tundra that covers vast areas of not only Alaska but parts of the Arctic. It's changing. Tundra is kind of a a low grass-like vegetation for people who've never seen it. But we're now getting increasing encroachment of shrubs there, larger shrubs, and trees are moving north. And again, just like in the sea ice, as this happens, it's going to change how that place looks in winter. Instead of being white everywhere, it'll be dark shrubs sticking up, and so it'll tend to warm faster that way.
So you're saying then that there's an acceleration process that goes on here, that as the sea ice gets thinner and there's less of it and less white to reflect as there is on the tundra, then that causes further warming?
Yes, that's right. Scientists call those feedback effects. And one of the interesting things is that the Arctic and Alaska in particular have a lot of these sort of feedback effects put in there. A lot of them just hinge on something very simple, and that's that white material like snow is just a very good reflector of sunlight, and usually what the white material was covering, vegetation or ocean on the sea ice, is not as good a reflector, and it absorbs more. So those feedbacks are there and kick in. The sea ice one's the one that's had a lot of attention.
What about the permafrost?
Permafrost is harder to see, and a little harder for people who haven't lived in Alaska to understand. If you go out in Alaska and you look at a landscape, it looks pretty normal. What you have to remember there is that, just like in Minnesota, during the summer where the ground's thawing and that thaws down to a certain depth, and then in winter that freezes back. In Minnesota, you just freeze and thaw that active layer. In Alaska, below that layer, which might only be 5 or 6 feet thick in a place like Minnesota, below that it's all frozen in many places in Alaska, and it's a little harder to tell what's going on there because we can't see it, but we can measure its temperature. So what we do is we drill a hole in it and put thermometers down there and basically watch it over time. And so what we know is two things have been going on. One is the permafrost, this thick frozen material below the active layer. It's warming up fairly dramatically all across Alaska. And in some places where the permafrost itself was quite thin, it's starting to go away, and the active layer is getting thicker. So this is totally consistent with what we saw. What's interesting with the permafrost is if you've got permafrost, it's pretty hard for water to infiltrate the ground. And when it freezes in the winter, the water flow stops. As soon as that active layer gets a little bit thicker, then we'll kick into a new regime that's got year-round groundwater flow. And that may also have some accelerating properties.
What
has...
No, go ahead. I wanted you to finish your point, but I thought you had. Go ahead.
Well, just again, the permafrost, though, is the one that's a little bit hardest for us to monitor.
Okay. What is the impact of all of this on the people that live in Alaska, particularly those who have been there for many hundreds of years?
With the one that's gotten a lot of note is the reduction in sea ice. That's having a direct impact certainly on Native folks who hunt, because a lot of their hunting activities is based on moving around and on the ice dealing with whales. They're still able to do it, but they tell me, the folks I talk to, it's just not as predictable as it used to be. And eventually, if that ice goes away, the very species they hunt, seals, polar bears, and whales, these will change as well. In addition, as the ice has gone away, it's increased the amount of coastal erosion. As long as you've got an ice cover right up to your shoreline, it's pretty hard to get a big storm in there with waves. In fact, you can't do that. But if you keep the area ice-free in the fall later, that's when we get our big storms. You get a lot more big storms, and it tends to erode the coast. These are actually threatening a number of villages throughout Alaska, since they're built right on the coast.
So, again, given the fact that these villages have been there for a long time and all this is happening now, I take it that the people who live there, as well as you scientists, are determining that something is changing very significantly.
Yeah, there's a palpable sense, certainly in Alaska, among villagers and just people in town like Fairbanks, where I live, as well as scientists, that something is changing. There's no question about it. There are a lot of things that people see that they may think are related, but there's too many things we know are definitely connected to this set of changes that are accompanying what seems to be a changing climate.
All right. Once again, and this delegation of senators is up there this week taking a look at all of this, too. Matthew Sturm, again, is a geophysicist with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Cold Regions Research and Engineering Lab in Fairbanks. Dave Klein is an emeritus professor of biology and wildlife at the University of Alaska. He spent many years studying wildlife in that region. And Professor Klein, to you now, what about the impact on the animals?
Well, there are many impacts, and the more we look into the effects of climate change on wildlife and wildlife habitat, the more unknowns seem to appear. In other words, we're learning rapidly, but there are some obvious impacts, and they're mostly indirect, although Matthew mentioned the changing sea ice conditions, which definitely has major impacts on marine mammals, which are dependent upon sea ice. A walrus is a prime example. They rest on the sea ice, feed on ice off of the ice by diving to the bottom in the coastal shelf areas of the northern seas, the Bering Sea, as well as the Arctic Ocean. And as the sea ice declines, it moves further from shore into deeper water beyond the depth that they can feed, and it really has a really positive and a direct influence on the walrus. And again, declining sea ice affects breeding by the seals, which are an important food source for both humans, but also for who are the indigenous peoples of the Arctic coasts and who hunt them throughout the winter on the sea ice. And as the sea ice declines and moves away from shore in the summer, these seals, which normally live in this under sea ice and have their young on top of the ice, are finding it more and more difficult to find rough old ice that is suitable for creating snowdrifts, which is what they use as their denning sites for having their young. Polar bears similarly are breeding and denning, having their maternal dens on the sea ice, and more are coming to the land where they tend to get marooned on the land as the sea ice declines in the spring and summer, and that creates problems for the bears, creates problems for people that where the bears wander into communities and are real threats to life and property in those areas.
Any of these species that you've mentioned, the seals, the walrus, and the polar bears, actually endangered as a result of the climate change?
Well, they're in danger locally in terms of their habitat locally, and that will affect their populations, and total populations worldwide will decline. Whether they're doomed to extinction, for example, the polar bears, it's a question of both polar bears and seals, but certainly the suitable habitats will decline, and they will perhaps some habitats in the high Arctic may improve. But most of the areas where people are used to seeing and knowing that polar bears exist, many of those areas will the quality of their habitats for polar bears and seals will decline, and their populations will decline.
Let me ask you to elaborate a bit, if you will, on what we heard earlier from Matthew Sturm about the impact of this on the villages in Alaska.
Well, the villages, virtually all the coastal villages, and most, the highest density of Native people in Alaska is on the coastal areas. The marine environment is a rich environment. But the ability for these people to access food is very much dependent upon sea ice and its duration, seasonal duration. So while it doesn't mean that there's not going to be sea ice again in the wintertime, it means there's a briefer period when the sea ice is there. And that period in the spring, which is very important, that's when the marine mammals frequently, such as whales, are migrating along the edges of the ice in open leads. Period and opportunity for hunting these animals is decreasing. Plus, the animals themselves are changing their migration routes further and further offshore as the sea ice declines.
What about the villages that depend on permafrost, where the permafrost is melting away?
Well, they do depend on permafrost in several ways. One is that their stability of their buildings on the land adjacent to the sea is dependent upon the presence of permafrost in many cases. And so permafrost thawing creates problems both for maintaining the stability of the buildings. And these are not only their homes, but all of the schools and other services that are in buildings provide health and other services that are provided by the state or federal governments. And so the question, and then the beach erosion, which is accelerating, both because of the melting of the permafrost, which makes the coast more erodible, but also the wave action, which Matthew Stern implied as a result of a later freeze-up in the fall during the normal stormy period, results in accelerated erosion. And so some of the villages will have to be moved to new locations or moved further back from the coast, which is very expensive, usually exceeding the ability of the local village to meet the expenses to move the buildings of the village.
Let me ask you, go ahead.
Well, then, but I was going to point out that there are many effects on terrestrial wildlife that are also important, and some of these affect coastal villagers. For example, many of the areas, such as even Barrow and northernmost village in Alaska, they hunt caribou and other terrestrial wildlife, but caribou are a major food source for these people. And we know that there are important effects of changing the environment and the habitat that is a product of climate change. And Matthew mentioned the increasing shrub growth, and that shrub growth usually is associated with declining quality of forage available for the caribou. The main shrubs that are increasing are alder and birch, dwarf birch. And these are not good forage for the caribou. The caribou are dependent upon other species. In the wintertime, heavily dependent upon lichens, which grow in a moist environment. And also sedges and other Arctic tundra plants that are the green plants that are good summer forage.
Okay. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk more about this. What we're learning here is the same thing that Hillary Clinton, John McCain, and other senators have been learning on their trip this week to Alaska. Senator McCain calls it a little scary. Senator Clinton says, I don't think there's any doubt left that for anybody who actually looks at the science and sees what's going on here, they're, of course, trying to institute changes, regulations, and limitations on the emission of greenhouse gases. We'll talk a little bit about the politics of all of this and what it might mean for the rest of the United States as well, what's going on up there in Alaska. On Reporter's Notebook a bit later on, Race and Gender in American Medicine, all on To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warman Alnibak with To the Point. We're talking today about climate change in Alaska, something that a delegation of senators from other states is now looking at without the cooperation, however, of the senators and the one congressman from Alaska itself. I want to turn now to what the implications of all of this might be elsewhere. Peter Glick is president of the Pacific Institute. That's a nonprofit that provides research and policy analysis on various issues. He's also a MacArthur Fellow who did some of the earliest research on the impact of climate change on water resources. Peter Glick, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Warren. Thanks for having me.
Why should Americans in the lower 49 be concerned about what's going on right now in Alaska?
Well, we've really heard two things from Matthew and David. First of all, we've heard about how connected climate change is to everything we care about. In Alaska, higher temperatures affects the sea ice. Changes in sea ice affects the coastal populations and erosion and animal populations. That affects hunting and the local economy and ultimately human health. So climate affects everything we care about, and we're seeing direct examples of this in Alaska. The other thing we've heard from my colleagues is how fast and significant are the changes that we're seeing in Alaska. But the reality is we're seeing those changes everywhere. Climate's changing faster in Alaska than it is, and the Arctic, faster than in many other parts of the globe because of the way the climate system works. But we're already seeing higher sea level around the globe. We're already seeing changes in water availability and runoff in California and the western United States. We're already seeing higher temperatures affecting human health all over the place. Really what's happening in Alaska is a snapshot, if you will, a microcosm of the kinds of climate changes that are going to occur and are already occurring around the globe.
We heard earlier about something called feedback and the feedback effects with specifically the decline of the white sea ice leading to the absorption of heat and consequently accelerating the pace of global warming. Are there those kinds of feedback effects elsewhere as well? It seems to me it's something that's difficult to see. It's sort of counterintuitive and yet could be very important.
Yes, those feedback effects are critical to this entire question. One of the reasons why it's warming faster in the Arctic and Alaska than the globe as a whole is because of these feedback effects. As Matthew mentioned, when you lose ice and snow, more sunlight's absorbed by the ground because it's darker, stuff that would have been reflected off to space. And so it's warming up faster in the northern latitudes than it is on average everywhere. But these kinds of feedback effects are occurring everywhere, and they're particularly worrisome. And there are lots of different kinds, which we can go into or not. But
well, give us one example.
Well, another example is clouds. Clouds also either reflect sunlight away from the planet or absorb sunlight, depending on where they are. Well, we're beginning to see changes in cloud patterns, and some of those changes may make climate change occur faster and be felt more than we otherwise would expect. Another one is somewhat of an arcane one. It turns out there are something called hydrates, methane hydrates, that are captured and frozen in the northern latitudes in the Arctic, in permafrost, which you've talked about. Methane is a very strong greenhouse gas. We don't want a lot more methane in the atmosphere because it will make climate change faster and worse. And yet, as the Arctic warms up and as parts of Siberia warm up, it turns out we may be releasing more methane faster into the atmosphere than we anticipated, and that could be another one of these feedback effects.
All right. We have now in Alaska this visitation of the various senators from other states, including Senators McCain and Clinton, also Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, and Senator Susan Collins of Maine as well. And they're taking a very different position from that of the Alaska delegation itself. We have Susan Collins, for example, from Maine, saying the Arctic is a canary in the mine shaft. And we have the Ted Stevens and Lisa Murkowski, the senators from Alaska, and Congressman Don Young up there, saying that they're not persuaded as yet that it's necessary to take the kinds of actions of limiting greenhouse gases and so on that the other senators are advocating, particularly because they're saying it's not clear at this point that human behavior is, in fact, the cause of all of this. What do you, Peter Glick, at the Pacific Institute, have to say to that?
Well, I think what we're seeing here is the odd and sometimes peculiar intersection of science and politics. From a science point of view, it is very clear that climate change is going to occur. It is very clear that climate change is already occurring. And I would argue that it's very clear to the scientific community that humans are responsible for the majority of climate change. Not all of it. We do have some natural climate change that has always occurred over time. But the science community is very strong in its feeling that the climate changes that we're now seeing can be explained by nothing, cannot be explained unless you include human implications, human impacts. Now, Don Young and Ted Stevens in the Alaskan delegation, they've actually changed their tune in the last few years. They used to say there was no climate change and there wasn't going to be any. Now they're saying, yes, we see climate change because it's pretty indisputable, especially in Alaska, but we don't think humans are responsible. Well, I don't think that's right either from a science point of view. Ultimately, they're going to have to change that tune as well. And then the debate really becomes, all right, if humans are responsible, what do we do about it? And that, I think, is a very legitimate political debate.
You say that the human cause is clear to you because it can't be explained otherwise. What do you mean by that?
Here's what I mean. There's a very clear record that shows how much temperature is going up, for example, around the world. And temperature has gone up enormously in the last century, far faster than we would otherwise expect from just natural changes in the climate. And when you look at the things that change climate naturally, over decades or millennia even, changes in the orbit of the planet, changes in the output of the sun, changes in the tilt of the planet, those things change the natural climate of the Earth. But if you add up all of those effects, they're not enough to explain the changes that we've seen. And in fact, if you put into the climate models the human element, then in fact, it explains it very well. And what it tells us is that humans are responsible for the majority, more than half, and probably closer to 80 or 90% of the changes in climate that we've seen over the last century.
All right. Then the question, as you say, the legitimate political debate to follow is, what do we do about it? What do you think we ought to do about it?
Well, I think we're sort of stuck in dealing with two different things. First of all, there are going to be unavoidable impacts of climate change, no matter what we do. If we were to stop burning fossil fuels today, which we won't, and stop emitting greenhouse gases today, which we can't, there would still be climate changes simply because of the gases we've already put into the atmosphere. So to some degree, we're going to be stuck dealing with unavoidable impacts, things that we're already seeing happen in Alaska, as you've heard about already. I do think, however, that the things that we can do to reduce greenhouse gas emissions are critically important because we want to slow the rate of climate change in order to give us, first of all, more time to deal with impacts, and we want to slow the rate of climate change in order to reduce the size of the ultimate impacts that we have to deal with. And that ultimately means dealing with fossil fuels. We have to cut back on our emissions of fossil fuels primarily.
Peter Glick, again, president of the Pacific Institute, MacArthur Fellow, did some of the early research on climate change and its impact on water resources. Juliet Alperin is a national environmental reporter for The Washington Post. She has just joined us, but heard the last few comments from Peter Glick. And, Juliet, we've also heard from Matthew Sturm with the Army Corps of Engineers in Alaska and Dave Klein, professor emeritus of wildlife ecology at the University of Alaska, talk about what is happening in Alaska right now, the kinds of things that the senators are seeing as they tour Alaska. So with that in mind, let me go to you and ask you, where now in Congress, particularly given what the position of the Bush administration has been, does this issue stand? And have congressmen begun to make the sorts of changes that other congressmen that Peter Glick just described on the part of the Alaska delegation, first saying there is no global warming, now saying, yeah, there is, but we're not sure it's human?
Exactly. Well, things are really in a state of limbo or a state of flux, I would say. What's happened is that you are seeing some shifts. People who you referred to, I talked to Lisa Murkowski about this issue several weeks ago, and you know, she has certainly moved in her position. She said, you know, you don't have to explain global warming to me. I see it in my own state.
Senator from Alaska.
Senator from Alaska, Republican. Lindsey Graham, a Republican from South Carolina, who came to, who also went on that trip, mm-hmm. is another interesting swing vote. These are Republicans who say, they say, you know, not only is climate change happening, but we do believe humans have a lot to do with this. The question is, what do we need to act? What do we need to do to act? How quickly do we have to act? And how serious a set of restrictions do we have to impose on industry in order to make a difference? And that's what they're struggling with. And there's absolutely no consensus in either the Senate or the House or how to proceed. And so that's the problem. They seem more and more convinced on the science, but stymied about where to go in terms of policy.
You mentioned Lindsey Graham, the Republican from South Carolina, who also, as I understand it, has raised a question of national security in this context.
Right. I mean, I think part of the issue, and you hear both some Democrats and Republicans talking about this, is you know, this presents a long-term national security threat to the United States, both, you know, in terms of energy dependence and also just in terms of what it's going to mean in terms of our environment and what steps we're going to have to take to maintain the country that we have as it stands today.
Senator McCain, who's now in Alaska, and Senator Lieberman, a Democrat from Connecticut, well-known, of course, as a former vice presidential candidate, have a bill. What's the bill say, and what are its prospects for passing?
That bill has run into trouble lately. That bill would establish a mandatory cap and trade system for carbon emissions, which have been linked to the global warming. So essentially, what it would say is it would try to get the country to reduce its carbon dioxide emissions through a trading scheme where different power plants and so forth could exchange with each other depending on whether they were making reductions faster or slower. And this is something that's gotten some support, but it actually lost ground recently in the context of an energy bill vote. It went down below 40 votes, and which is clearly short of what it needs for passage.
In the Senate.
And so essentially, while the Senate did adopt in the context of this energy bill debate a non-binding resolution saying we support the idea of some kind of mandatory system to reduce carbon dioxide emissions, they won't commit to an actual plan, and that's the problem that they're having.
Is there any way to assess how much longer it might be before there is, in fact, some consensus, or are things just in such a state of flux that that's impossible to estimate?
It's really a hard question to answer. One of the other things, which I haven't mentioned yet, is that the House leadership is adamantly against any kind of mandatory cap on carbon dioxide emissions. And so that's a problem. Even if you can get something through the Senate, which offers the best possibility for action, then you reach the problem that you have also a Republican-controlled House that really has very little interest in dealing with this issue and you know, rejects even the idea of a non-binding resolution on the matter. So the way that, you know, Senator Lieberman and Senator McCain always say is that, you know, they think we will act eventually, and the question is, do we act too late? Is it 5 years? Is it 10 years from now? I certainly don't see something happening this Congress. And I think the question is, can centrists, can people like Murkowski and others and McCain and Lieberman, can they broker some kind of compromise within the next year or two that could bring people together to adopt some kind of mandatory cap-and-trade scheme?
This Congress, of course, will be in office until the end of next year after the November elections, 2006. Well, what does the leadership say about their adamant opposition, given the consensus of science and the kinds of concerns we hear expressed by even moderate Republicans, including Murkowski of Alaska, who is in a state that's described as not just red but crimson? That sounds like a fairly courageous kind of stand on her part, given the constituency that she has.
Right, although I think it's fair to say her constituents include, for example, Native Americans who are having their whole way of life threatened by climate change. I mean, some of the people she answers to are some of these villagers who are having their hunting season disrupted. You know, she is listening. She is being a true representative, and she's listening to what people are saying. I would say in terms of what the House leadership says is they really take the exact same line that the administration has taken, which is an adamant position that any kind of mandatory curb on carbon dioxide emissions will cost American jobs, and it's simply not acceptable. And they think that federal money should go into promoting research, into cleaner technology, without actually demanding that companies change what they're doing.
Again, Julia Alperin is National Environmental Reporter for The Washington Post. Let me go back to Peter Glick of the Pacific Institute, a former MacArthur fellow. You said earlier that this debate that we're hearing about now is, in fact, a very legitimate one. What's your position on the length of time involved? Here we have Senator McCain and others saying, are we going to do this in time? You said earlier that we have two things to do. One is to slow the rate. The other is to cope with the changes that already are occurring. Can you put any sort of time frame on when we're going to really be able to feel the impact of climate change in New York, San Francisco, Florida, and other parts of the country?
Well, the truth is we're already feeling it. We're already feeling it in Alaska, but we're already feeling it in the Southwest, where the heat and the high temperature degree days are regularly exceeding anything we've seen historically. We're already seeing it along our coasts, where the sea levels are slowly, but I would argue inexorably, rising. It's really a trade-off here. The longer we take to make to implement policy to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, voluntary actions aren't going to be enough, I think was the message that we're starting to hear, then the greater the impacts are going to be on society, and the faster those impacts are going to get worse and worse. So we're already seeing impacts. We have to work on both sides of this equation, reducing emissions and dealing with impacts. And the longer we deal with, the longer we put off dealing with the emissions side of things, the more severe the impacts are going to be.
Juliet Alperin, you mentioned the question of jobs. Also, there are issues, as I understand it, with the business community, the big corporations, some of which have to deal internationally. And there, of course, are new regulations being imposed under the Kyoto Protocols and other places. And they're also concerned about what the direct impacts are going to be on the businesses that they conduct. Are they changing? And if they do, might that have an impact on the Republicans in Congress?
Yes, it's a really good question you're raising. And yeah, it's one thing we're always monitoring. To what extent is the business community, particularly, again, with large international holdings, which now have to answer to, for example, curbs in Europe and elsewhere, what, you know, to what extent are they ultimately going to seek a scheme that's uniform across the globe? And we're seeing a little bit of that. We're seeing people like one of the top executives from Synergy, a major energy company, saying, look, we in Exelon is another example, saying we want one kind of scheme that we can conform to for all our operations, and we see this as, you know, a sound long-term business decision. You're also seeing places like GE, the CEO from GE, saying, again, we think it's green in terms of making money to be green, to limit carbon dioxide emissions. But on the other hand, you have major oil producers, people like, you know, companies like ExxonMobil, who remain firmly opposed to any kind of mandatory limits.
All right. An update and progress report on one of the major issues of our times. Thank you all very much for being with us. Juliet Alperin, a national environmental reporter for The Washington Post, Peter Glick, president of the Pacific Institute, Dave Klein, our earlier guest in the first part of our program, emeritus professor at the University of Alaska, and Matthew Sturm, also on the first part of our program, geophysicist with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers up in Alaska. We'll come back to this in the future and hope all of you will join us again. In the 1980s, it was first reported that black Americans got fewer operations, tests, medications, and other life-saving treatments than whites. Decades later, there has been little progress in closing that gap. The latest New England Journal of Medicine says it's time to start talking and figure out what can be done. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Warman Only back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. The most recent New England Journal of Medicine devotes 32 pages to three studies on the disparity in medical treatment between blacks and whites. One of them is called Sex and Racial Differences in the Treatment and Outcome of Acute Myocardial Infarction, 1994 through 2002. The lead author is Yale Professor of Cardiology Harlan Krumholtz. Doctor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
What is, if you can summarize it quickly for a lay audience, the burden of your report and its conclusions?
Yeah, our report looked at whether or not we've been making any interval progress in eliminating disparities, and actually the other two articles similarly tried to make some assessment of whether or not there have been important changes over time. What we found was that after looking at heart attack care, that there was some important variation by sex and race in particular procedures and treatments, and that there had been relatively little change in the differences from 1994 through 2002.
Tell us about the differences. How much of a disparity is there between what blacks get, what women get, and what whites how much of a disparity, both in terms of sex and race?
Yeah, so I think, well, there was a little bit of good news in our report where we looked at several different treatments for heart attacks, and for at least two of them, the use of aspirin, the use of beta blockers, there seemed to be relatively little difference in the way that people were treated on the basis of their race, ethnicity, or by sex. But there was some evidence that what we call reperfusion therapy, that is someone coming in with a heart attack who has a blocked artery, needs either a medication or a procedure in order to open the artery and reestablish the blood flow. And there's evidence that that varies by race in ways that are very difficult to understand. And the differences actually can be quite substantial and a little bit concerning, that even maybe up to a 10% difference in the use of these treatments. And leading us to question, you know, what's underlying it? Why haven't we fixed it? And why is it why is it really the same? Well, these treatments are known to help people live longer, and we're finding evidence that they aren't being uniformly applied.
So the evidence is there. Again, let me ask the question asked by the or raised by the Journal New England Journal of Medicine, which is, if we've known this, we've known it for as long as we have, why haven't we done more?
Right. I think all three articles are trying to say, you know, what's the report card on this? We've been spending a decade or more talking about disparities. There's been report upon report, and each of these three articles tried to take the approach of saying, well, you know, what's happened? One of the articles had a little more optimistic news. It was looking at managed care organizations and saw that there had been improvements in overall quality of care and some diminution in the differences by race. Our article was less optimistic with regard to heart attack care. One of the things I think that's important to note when you look at these studies is that we have ways to go to improve care for everyone. So even the white patients, the group that would be considered more favorably treated, is not being treated as well as many of us would like within a healthcare system. We're still missing opportunities maybe 1 in 10 times, sometimes 1 in 5 times. That is, 1 in 5 or 1 in 10 patients who come to the hospital are not getting treatments that they should get. We are seeing differences in some of these treatments by race, but we shouldn't be happy just merely to eliminate those differences. But the question is, how can we achieve a system where everybody gets exactly what they need when they need it? And if we can do that, if we can ensure that every patient gets the treatments that they deserve and that will benefit them, at least are offered those, then we will eliminate disparities. So both groups are not where we need to be. It's additionally disturbing that there seem to be extra differences and that there are some groups, particularly defined by race and sex, that are falling even further behind, and we're not making that progress.
Talking to Dr. Harlan Krumholz, a cardiologist at Yale University School of Medicine, author of one of these three studies. Well, in the meantime, before we try to raise all boats, can you talk a little bit about the possible causes for the disparities that you have seen? Are they socioeconomic? Do they have to do with different kinds of hospitals in different communities?
All right, well, some of the work we're doing has suggested more recently that at least some of the differences that we're seeing by race are accounted for by the type of hospitals that minority patients are more likely where minority patients are more likely to seek care. That is, that there seems to be some obstacle to access to higher quality hospitals, and that if you take into account those hospitals, and at those hospitals both whites and blacks are getting poor quality care, it's just that they're seeing more minority patients. So one of the remedies here is going to be to identify hospitals that are essentially practicing substandard care and to make sure that they improve and to make it really unacceptable. And part of that has come through efforts by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services and the Joint Commission for Accreditation of Hospitals and Healthcare Organizations, as they've tried to publicly report data to show the real performance of hospitals, to bring about greater degrees of accountability, and to try to encourage hospitals to take a good look at the kind of care that they're delivering and determine whether or not they need to elevate it. So at least some of this may have to do with the hospitals that people are going to. The differences that you see by sex, of course, wouldn't be expected to be a hospital-based issue in the sense that hospitals are caring for both men and women, and this isn't a matter of women just going to certain hospitals and men going to others. And so we have to dig a little deeper to kind of understand what might be responsible for these patterns of care.
Talk about that a little more. What about the gender differences?
Yeah, I think that there's a long ingrained expectation that women really don't suffer as much from heart disease, and certainly in the last decade, there's a growing appreciation and discussion about how susceptible women are, particularly older women, for heart disease, and how women aren't really completely protected from heart disease. In our national consciousness, we associate breast cancer and other conditions with women. We haven't historically associated heart disease as much with women. There are national campaigns like the one the American Heart Association and American College of Cardiology and NIH have been promoting to try to raise awareness. But if you look at the historic curriculums of medical schools, whenever they were talking about heart disease, they would present cases of middle-aged men. They wouldn't really promote the idea that people need to be sensitive to the particular issues of women. It may be that that had led to certain patterns of care, certain expectations when people come to the emergency department, certain differences in aggressiveness of treatment. And these are things which I think may be culturally need to be addressed.
So that some of these things, then, you're saying go all the way back to medical school.
Yeah, I think the way in which we're sort of socialized about the way in which certain illnesses present and who's affected by them and how we should be caring for them can have effects all the way down the line.
Will it be helpful to have more African-American doctors, more women doctors?
Well, I think it's always important to try to ensure that the healthcare workforce is reflective of society as a whole, and the degree to which we're all working with people of different backgrounds, races, ethnicities, sexes, is going to enrich the field. I don't think we want to get to a point where we say that in order for a black person to get good care, they've got to receive care from a black doctor. But I do think that by having a very multicultural and a sort of mixed workforce, that we are learning from each other, and it elevates the entire field.
Well, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Dr. Harlan Krumholtz, a cardiologist at Yale University. Today's program produced by Christian Bordahl with Andrea Brody and Jennifer Son, technical director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.